Welcome to the podcast of Focus 580, featuring interviews with newsmakers and experts on international affairs and daily life, hosted by David Inge at WILL Radio, Urbana, Illinois. Please support this service by becoming a member and visit us on the web at will.uiuc.edu.
Welcome back to the second hour of Focus 580, our morning talk program. I'm David Inge. The producers for the show, Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal. This morning, we're bringing you programs from the Focus 580 archive. So do remember, as you listen, we'll not be taking your calls. In this hour of the show, we will talk a little bit about the history of electoral manipulation in the United States, something that concerns a lot of people now. And when you use that kind of phrase, people, I think, automatically will think about the presidential elections of the last couple of times around, particularly that of 2000 and what happened in the state of Florida. However, our guests for this part of Focus 580, Andrew Gumbel, will tell you that that is nothing new in American history. In fact, the first formal complaint of vote fraud in the United States happened way back in 1789. This morning, our guest is Andrew Gumbel. He works for The Independent. It's a British newspaper. He has been a journalist now for the past 18 years, working mostly as a foreign correspondent. He worked for Reuters, and then after that worked for The Guardian, and since 1995 has worked for The Independent. He is a U.S.-based correspondent for The Independent. He is based in Los Angeles. He's also contributed to The L.A. Times, L.A. Weekly, L.A. City Beat, and other publications. He's the author of the book Steal This Vote. The subtitle is Dirty Elections and the Rotten History of American Democracy. It's now in a paper published by Nation Books and reviews some of the history of voting in America, some of the problems that have been around virtually since the country's beginning. And it also looks at some of the technological solutions that have been embraced all the way along. One of the basic points he makes is that people have said, well, yes, we have problems with voting, but technology can fix that. But it doesn't seem to have helped. Every time some new kind of method of voting comes along, people say, well, this is going to be the solution, and it never seems to turn out that way. Mr. Gumbel, hello.
Yes, hello.
Thanks for talking with us.
Oh, you're very welcome.
We appreciate it. I'd like to hit the basic points here at the beginning, and then we can go back and talk a little bit in more in detail. And maybe just to start out with that point that I tried to make here in the introduction, and you might want to amplify it on that a little bit, and that is that the fact that maybe people think that this is something new, or when they think about the problems with voting, they will think about the 2000 presidential race. But in fact, there is nothing new about manipulating elections and stealing votes in the United States. It goes back some time.
Absolutely. And I would have thought with your listenership being in Illinois, not too far away from Chicago, they'd be more than aware of that, at least in certain parts of the country. What I found out in the course of researching the book was that, you know, it's not really just a matter of corrupt political machines in Chicago or elsewhere. It's not just a matter of individual elections like the 2000 presidential election and again in 2004. It's really something much more systemic. And it has to do with the very peculiar way in which democracy developed in the United States, which is a very different story from the development of democracy in any other of the world's mature developed countries. And essentially what I found is that, you know, the real root of the corruption comes from the two-party system. Now, electoral corruption existed long before the Democrats and the Republicans were ensconced as the natural parties in this country, but essentially at the time when Europe was cleaning up its act in the late 19th century was precisely the time when, first of all, the Democrats and the Republicans were taking control. Secondly, it was when they really stopped competing against each other and developed separate fiefdoms. In the South, of course, the Democrats were pretty much uncontested, the segregationist governments that existed in the former states of the Confederacy. The Republicans were in control in a lot of the northern states. They were, for a long time, in more or less uncontested control of Congress and the White House in the early part of the 20th century. You had a sort of collapse of electoral competition, a lack of interest, really, in fostering that competition. And the system became stultified as almost a kind of marriage of convenience between these two rivals who didn't particularly have an interest in making participation in elections a big feature. Participation, as we know now, tends to hover around the 50% mark at best in presidential elections and much lower for local races and off-year races. That's not a coincidence. And secondly, there's been no interest in developing an infrastructure for the management of elections. So both parties have found it in their interest to have rather mediocre managers with rather lousy machinery that can be manipulated as and when the opportunity arises and when the stakes are high enough for one party or the other to want to make mischief. Mm-hmm. And this is really the salient feature of American democracy as it has existed, certainly for the last 100 years, but in modified form more or less since the dawn of the Republic.
And just to underscore what you've said, because, again, recently there was a lot of anger and discontent directed from people on the left towards the right, particularly in regards to the presidential election of 2000. If you look back in American history and, again, look at the history of manipulating elections, both parties have done it. Republicans have done it. Democrats have done it. So you can't say one or the other is more guilty.
Absolutely. Well, one of the things that I've been repeating a lot recently is to make the argument that this is not a partisan issue. It's a voting rights issue, and it should concern everyone. But the part of the problem with the two-party system is that inevitably one party or the other is in the ascendant, which means the one that's at the disadvantage is going to be the one complaining the most about election fraud and mismanaged elections. So you had the situation up to the late 1980s, where the Democrats controlled Congress, and it was the Republicans that tended to complain more about the way elections were run to their disadvantage. There was a notorious case in Indiana in 1984 where the Republican was deemed on a recount to have come out ahead in a congressional race, but the Democrat-controlled Congress in Washington refused to seat the Republican candidate and seated the Democrat instead, which triggered an absolute fury, quite rightly so, among the Republicans in Congress and elsewhere. In the last few years, since 1994, of course, the Republicans have controlled Congress. They now control the White House as well. The House since 1994. They now control the White House and the Senate as well. And most of the complaints inevitably come from the Democrats. And I think a lot of Democrats have made what I believe to be a tactical mistake of seeing this as a very specific, almost conspiratorial attempt by the Republicans in cahoots, perhaps with voting machine companies, to rob America of its democracy. If you go back in history, you see that it's much more of a wave pattern. That it's a question of who has the opportunity, as I say, and how high the stakes are to make mischief. And I think the key thing now is to convince ordinary Republican voters that this is an issue that affects them. If you take a state like Ohio, which is currently run by the Republicans, most of the complaints, if not all of the complaints, come from the Democrats. It is, however, a state where the Republican establishment is being hit by one scandal after another and is in something of a meltdown mode. It's very easy to see that the Democrats might be in charge of Ohio as early as the end of this year when they have the midterm elections, at which point the boot will be on the other foot. And if you have a lousy system, then it's going to be the Republicans who are at a disadvantage. That point is not made nearly enough. And as a result, there is almost no cross-party dialogue on this issue. It's been turned into you're a sore loser versus you're a corrupt winner. And that's not enough in order to push the debate forward and to think of ways of solving this problem.
Yeah. Maybe just one further of the basic points that I think that you make that comes through again and again, and that is that this is a problem we have seen now going back some way in American history. And it's a problem that has been recognized. And so in an attempt to solve it, people have come up with technological solutions. And every time one of these has come along, it seems to have been disappointing, and yet people then, when the next one came, and when we moved from the uniform ballot to mechanical voting machines to the punch cards, now to computerized voting with touchscreens, every time some new thing has come along, people have said, well, this is going to solve the problem. Unfortunately, it never seems to have solved the problem.
Right. Well, you've got this fascinating confluence between people who don't want to solve the problem because it suits them politically not to, who speak the language of reform because it suits their agenda in a rather twisted way. And then you have the bona fide reformers who don't see that the fundamental problem is one of political organization. They believe that it is one of just getting the right machine that's going to prevent the shenanigans from occurring. And every time the hope is raised and every time the hope is dashed, when the punch card machines that became notorious in Florida in 2000 were first introduced in the early 60s, there was an election official in Georgia who proclaimed excitedly that it was easier than stirring coffee with a spoon, thought this was the greatest thing ever. It later turned out not only that you had the problem with the CHADS, which is to say that the detachable part of the ballot didn't detach properly over time. You also had problems with the possibility of manipulation of the pages of the ballot book that was used in the punch card system. You had problems with the possibility of tampering with the computer program that ran the tabulation, and on and on and on and on. All problems that were analyzed by a very small group of expert computer scientists, but got almost no wider airplay at the time until Florida came along in 2000. Now with the computer voting, there is actually, this is both a continuation of the same trend to the extent that people wanted to believe that computers could solve everything, and they didn't take care to make sure that the computers were programmed properly, that there was proper public oversight, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But it also poses a brand new threat, which is that in the old days, if with punch cards or with lever machines, you could make mischief, but the mischief was really restricted to one jurisdiction, one precinct, or at the most one county. With the electronic voting machines that have tabulation systems that are applied to many, many counties, in some cases in many more than one state, you have the opportunity of making mischief undetectably through a change in the software program, and it can affect elections not only in one county, not only in one state, but across the country. And that's a very alarming new development, which is one of the reasons why in the last few years there's been so much furore and anxious questioning of what it is the country is doing to its own democratic integrity.
Let me introduce again our guest for this part of Focus 580. Andrew Gumbel is U.S. correspondent for the British newspaper The Independent. He's based in Los Angeles. He is the author of a recently published book titled Steal This Vote, Dirty Elections and the Rotten History of American Democracy, or Democracy in America. That's the subtitle, and it's published by Nation Books. I'm sure you can find it in the bookstore. Before he came to the United States, he was stationed mainly in Europe and covers a number of big stories, including the fall of the Berlin Wall, collapse of communism in the Soviet bloc, the wars in Yugoslavia, the rise of the Italian mogul turned politician Silvio Berlusconi, and he also writes the award-winning American Babylon column for the alternative LA weekly LA City Beat. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. You make an assertion that I think would concern a lot of people, although probably a lot of people would agree with it, and that is that, well, on the one hand, here in the United States, we talk a lot about, and people in government talk about, disengagement from politics as being a problem, low voter turnout, people who don't seem to follow current affairs, and say, you know, the government doesn't have anything to do with me, my vote doesn't matter. You make the argument that maybe part of the problems is that people in government, people who are professional politicians, don't really care, that in fact they're not that interested in broad popular participation in politics. Do you think that that's actually true?
Yes, absolutely. Well, both major parties have got a history of specifically suppressing the vote at different times. With the Democrats, obviously, the most salient example was refusing to allow blacks in the South to vote when they were in charge there. But it's even true now. If you look at, you know, even if you look at the John Kerry presidential campaign, you didn't really see any major interest on the part of the Democratic Party in growing new voters significantly outside of the few battlegrounds that they chose to focus on. There wasn't a sense that this was a grand exercise in democracy and everybody needed to be encouraged to participate. It was much more a sense of where do we need the crucial swing voters in order to pull this thing out of the hat. And that's always the pattern. On the Republican side of the fence, what you've seen most recently is an attempt in several states, Georgia most strikingly, but also six others. I just counted them this morning, Arizona, Texas, Indiana, Wisconsin, South Dakota, and Ohio. To claim that the real problem with voting in this country is that there is fraud on the level of people registering to vote and casting their vote, and so what you need is to pass stringent ID requirements for people coming to the polls. Now, I think this is actually a bogus issue, because if you look at the various problems that have existed in recent elections, the problem of people presenting to them to the polls under false pretenses is actually a very, very minor one. So first of all, it's not attacking the most important point, and secondly, the net effect of this is to mean that anybody who doesn't have a ready-to-hand government ID, i.e. a driving license, driver's license, is going to find it very difficult to vote and will almost certainly be turned off. And the analysis that I've seen suggests that it's roughly 12% of the electorate does not have a driver's license. A lot of these people are old. A lot of these people are poor. These are groups that tend to vote Democrat rather than Republican, number one. And number two, these are people who it's very easy to deter from going to vote. So it seems to me that there's only one possible motivation for pushing this line, which is to suppress the vote of the opposition. The same is true in certain southern states, especially in Florida, of discouraging or actively blocking the votes of former felons. In much of the country, it tends to be that once felons have completed their sentences and have completed their debt to society, their voting rights are restored. In Florida and in six other states, there's no automatic restoration. You have to go through a very lengthy application process. And again, that population tends to be more Democrat than Republican, and so someone like Governor Bush in Florida, who's a Republican, has absolutely no interest in changing the system. And you've got an estimated 600,000 former felons who are denied the chance to vote in Florida, and the trickle by which a handful of them are readmitted through the application process is completely inadequate to the task of making sure that everybody's votes are properly taken account of. So, you know, both parties in different ways have found it convenient to not let people vote rather than encourage maximum participation.
Well, that certainly points at one technique. If you're interested in making sure that your candidate wins, one can always find ways to stuff the ballot box. That's certainly traditional and has happened going back a long way. And if you can control the count, that can help. But another way to do it is to try to figure out who it is likely to vote for your opponent and then do what you can to make sure that they can't vote.
Right. A lot of what goes on these days happens before Election Day. We saw in the last election cycle, you know, secretaries of state in Florida and Ohio and elsewhere, but most notably in those two states, you know, going to inordinate lengths to try and deter people from registering to vote, to deter people from applying or filling out absentee ballots. In Florida, the state police was brought in to intimidate an absentee ballot collection operation in Orlando, which was the key city in the key swing stop, the swing part of the state. A very, very nasty little affair that went on there. In Ohio, you had the Republican Secretary of State, who was doubling as the co-chair of George Bush's re-election campaign there, putting out an order saying that absentee ballot applications had to be made on a certain thickness of paper. That order was then rescinded after a furore, but it probably caused a certain repression of the vote, and on and on and on and on. The other broader point that's worth making, and again can't be made enough, is how anomalous the practice of elections in the United States is. And when you're talking about voter apathy or voter disengagement, one of the salient things that is different here is that campaigns tend to occur principally through paid advertising rather than public forums to discuss the issues. In Britain, where I'm from, election campaigns are rather restricted in length, 3 or 4 weeks, and there are organized debates on specific policy issues that occurred mostly on television, with equal time given to all the candidates, and they discuss the issues, so the voters become educated. Here, as you know, all your listeners know, it's very much a kind of mudslinging, throw whatever negative thing you can at the opposition, come out with some catchy phrase that will support your cause without really explaining either what it is you stand for or what it is you intend to do when you get into office. And there's a real deterioration in civic debate on, you know, what it should be at the core of politics, which is what is public policy, what is politics for, what is it that the candidates are going to do, what differentiates them. And there's a great deal of dishonesty in terms of what is presented as a program of a candidate versus what they end up doing. And you know, this has two effects. Number one, it means that the public is less educated, so they understand less well what it is that is at stake. And secondly, it very specifically turns them off. They see process and they think this is just disgusting. They see the candidates of both parties are beholden to special interests who are bankrolling their campaigns, and they just don't want to have anything to do with it. Again, the money in politics, that's also rather peculiar, and it exists in other countries, but it's nowhere near to the extent that it exists here. The candidates find themselves beholden to special interests of it and feel obliged to pay favors back to when they get into office. That's not something that's good for democracy. There are, you know, a number of other things that make this system very different. Again, just to name one more for now, in almost every other country, you have a central electoral commission or similar body that lays down standards and rules for how elections are going to be conducted in a uniform way across the country. Here, not only do you have states taking charge of their own destiny as opposed to the federal government laying down guidelines, but you also have essentially an autonomous system, county by county, or even sometimes city by city, if that's the size of the particular jurisdiction. And as there are more than 4,000 counties in this country, you've effectively got more than 4,000 voting systems. none of which are accountable either to each other or to any central authority. For example, with the new generation of voting machines, there is a system of certifying them at the federal and at the state level, but at the federal level, there's no congressional oversight of the process whatsoever. It's conducted by private testing companies that are paid clients of the voting machine companies, and the only organization that oversees it is a volunteer organization called the Election Center based in Texas, which also takes money from the voting machine companies. So you've got colossal, you know, conflicts of interest, too much money in the system, lack of accountability, lack of any professional election management class that could rise above the partisan rancor. And right there, you've got a recipe for, you know, turning off voters and guaranteeing corruption in the process.
Hmm. Well, we have some callers here who'd like to come into the conversation. Let's do that. Start with the nearby community of Belgium. This would be line 4, toll-free line. Hello.
Good morning, sirs. I think the term you might want for our elections is a beauty contest, and it gets right down to it. Who's the prettiest face that seems to shine through to all of us voters? But to get to the point that I wanted to really, really pursue with you, isn't truly the problem being a two-party system? A view that doesn't want to be within those two mainstreams can never be seen or heard or felt in any sort of way because these two parties so strongly control the voting system, i.e. the Electoral College to start with. There's no way you can get around that if you're not Democratic and Republican. In those sort of ways, where other countries seem to allow a multitude of parties, and then the one that gets the highest percentage, 51% or whatever it is in these emerging democracies that do it, they seem to be the one that win, or you have a runoff between the two highest or something. Isn't that the way it's done?
You're absolutely right that the two-party system is, I think, a big part of the problem. And there are two-party systems elsewhere, Britain is being a good example, but it's nowhere near as rigorous as it is here. In Britain, there is a third party that always complains that it's not allowed to punch its proper weight because of the electoral system, which is a winner-takes-all system just like it is here. But the big difference is that you don't have the systematic exclusion of third parties that you do in the United States. Part of that is structural, as the caller says. The Electoral College makes it almost impossible for a third-party candidate to become president. Ross Perot was the most recent example of somebody who did reasonably well. Teddy Roosevelt in 1912, you have to go back to have a candidate who came even close to actually succeeding. And again, that's not a coincidence. When you see the way that such as they are, the candidates' debates are organized in elections, it's almost invariably just the Republican and the Democrat that are admitted. Other candidates are not allowed to participate. The one exception that was very bracing, I felt, was when they had the recall election in California in 2003, the one that saw Arnold Schwarzenegger come to power. For the first time, you had six leading candidates allowed into a single debate. You had the Green candidate, you had various alternative candidates within the two major parties, you had independents like Arianna Huffington, and it made the debate much, much better. My feeling is that if you had that kind of quality debate involving more voices, it would give voters the feeling that they were actually being represented as opposed to being made fun of by the two parties and the money that bankrolls them. Now, in terms of the beauty contest, I think that's actually a related problem, that when you don't talk about substance, what you talk about is charisma and personality, which is why the elections get so personal, why they get so negative, and why, in the end, you know, what distinguishes one candidate from another very often is a kind of a hunch feeling about, you know, this one has a nicer smile, this one is ruder. And we saw this, I think, quite noticeably in the 2000 election between Gore and Bush. The people saw the first couple of debates and decided whatever they thought of Gore's competence or his ability to argue the issues, they found him unsympathetic. He was huffing and puffing and looking superior, and that turned a lot of people off. And it's crazy to think that that would determine a presidential election. Let's not go into the other things that determine that presidential election, but clearly it made it a much closer race than it might otherwise have been. And I think this, you know, insistence on personality is not something that is healthy for a democracy.
Thank you very much, sir.
All right, thank you for the call. Well, given I have some other calls here, I promise we'll get to these folks. But given that there are so many different parties that have, not political parties, maybe so many different groups that have a vested interest in the system as it exists. Local election officials, we have the two parties who want to maintain their control, who don't want competition, who've made it almost impossible to unseat an incumbent, particularly at least when you're talking about the Congress. You have for-profit television broadcasters who make a great deal of money selling airtime for political advertising. You have the people who manufacture the technology for voting. There are all sorts of groups here in whose interest it is that nothing changes. Given that, how does anything change?
Right. Well, one thing you picked up on that I should have mentioned earlier in terms of the two parties not having an interest in increasing the number of voters is the way that congressional and legislative districts are carved up. As I'm sure a lot of your listeners are aware, there have been rounds of redistricting over the last 10, 20 years that have really calcified the system in a very alarming way. More than 99% of congressional seats are basically beyond the realm of meaningful competition and have been for the last few election cycles. That's not exactly a satisfactory democratic state of affairs. And indeed, coming into the 2006 midterms, you can look at the polls and make the determination that the Republican Party and the Bush administration are falling from favor with the electorate. But the chances of that being reflected, certainly in a linear way, in the makeup of Congress after the next elections is actually pretty restricted because it's almost impossible to kick incumbents out. Because of low participation on the whole, it becomes actually quite difficult even when an incumbent is not running for re-election for the party affiliation of the seat to change hands. And we've seen this again in the last election cycle. Again, to take California as an example, because I live here, in the 2004 cycle, there were 153 congressional and legislative races. In not a single one of them did the seat change party hands. And Arnold Schwarzenegger, you know, to his credit, got up a few days later and said, you know, what kind of democracy is that? And he's absolutely right. You then get to the question of redistricting reform, which has been tried now in California and Ohio, and people immediately become suspicious that this is being pushed by one party or the other for their own partisan advantage, rather than out of altruistic, independent desire for a better system. And that, again, is one of the pernicious things about a two-party system, is that once it's in place, nothing can change without that suspicion occurring.
Mr. Gumbel?
Yes, sorry. That was as far as I wanted to take it for now.
Oh, okay, good. Well, we have other callers, so let's go next to someone down in southern Illinois in Farina, and that's line one. Hello.
Hi. Good topic. And I have a real criticism for your guest. And not just your guest, but this magnanimous, kind of objective, all the Democrats do it too. Let's get this straight. Gore won the 2000 election. It was stolen from him by the Republican Supreme Court and the Republican administration that's currently in power. Okay, that being said, it's Republicans that own the Diebold company. I'm tired of the soft peddling of the Republicans' corruption and in bed with the big corporations. Okay, most of the people in this country are registered Democrats, and they become disgusted when they just wake up to the fact that we're being railroaded as a country. Another thing, too, that you mentioned, that the hanging Chad is a red herring. The punch card system works very well. It's the people that manipulate it. Well, yeah, and you did mention it, manipulate the counting system and so forth. And I don't know. And it becomes this. I have close friends that will never vote for a president again because they don't feel their vote counts because they see right through the sham and the reporting that's just too soft-peddling of the corruption. All right, well, thank you very much.
All right, well, thanks. Mr. Gumbel, you want to make some comment on that?
Well, absolutely. I mean, in the book, I talk about the 2000 election. I talk about things that have happened since, and I'm far from tender with the Republicans. And, what I write in the book is I think it's important to look at what both parties have done, but I also think it's important not to create false equivalences, which is what I think the court is accusing me of here. And, you know, rest assured that I have plenty of ammunition for the Republicans. In the 2000 election, I would agree that I think Gore, by any measure that I could come up with, should have won the election. There were a number of things that went wrong in Florida that were inadvertent, such as the design of the butterfly ballot in Palm Beach County, which alone robbed him of the election. There were other things that were done very deliberately, whether it was the suppression of the black vote in Florida, which I think was the single biggest factor, actually, especially this bogus felon purge list that was circulated, which eliminated the names of tens of thousands of voters from eligibility to vote, and it turned out that the list was riddled with errors. I mean, we're talking about 90% of the list being wrong. They didn't have provisional voting in Florida in 2000, so anybody who showed up at the polls was told you're not on the list. That was it. They couldn't vote. Tens of thousands of votes went missing that way, and it's reasonable, I think, to suppose that a majority of them would have gone to Gore. I can go on and on and on. I think this is deeply disturbing. I think the outrage the caller expresses is entirely appropriate. I would have one or two caveats. One, I wouldn't say that the Republicans have a monopoly on being beholden to corporate money. The Democrats are too, and that's a big part of the problem. Two, when it comes to the control of the voting machine companies, you said they're run by registered Republicans who donate liberally to Republican causes. That has been true. Diebold has now got a policy of not contributing to the parties, partly because they were massively embarrassed, especially by a fundraising letter sent out by their CEO in 2003, promising to deliver the state of Ohio for President Bush, which my interpretation of that is it was just colossally foot-in-mouth rather than evidence of a political conspiracy. Here's the point about the voting machine companies that I think people overlook. I think there is cause for concern that you have supporters of one party running the machinery, but I don't think the answer is to disqualify them or to say that this in and of itself is evidence of dishonesty. I think the answer is to create transparency in the system so that these machines are accountable, so that we know they work. And, you know, as one of my favorite analysts of this whole issue, a prominent computer scientist called Rebecca Mercury, told me once, she said, you know, if the machines are accountable, then who gives a crap who owns them? Pardon the vulgarity. But I think that is really the key point. If you look at the structure of the voting machine companies, I don't think you can sustain the idea that it was for political motives that companies like Diebold got into the business of voting machine companies. I think after the 2000 election, when it was clear that all the punch cards were going to be replaced across the country, all the 11 machines were going to be replaced too, a number of companies saw an opportunity to make a very large amount of money very quickly. They dived into the election business. Diebold bought a company called Global Election Systems that had been around for a few years. There were other purchases that went on. It rapidly became clear with the way the system is set up, with the requirements of certification, for the requirements of testing, with the need to sweet talk officials at county level, at state level, in an awful lot of states, that the opportunities for making money, first of all, were not particularly rosy over the long term, but secondly, that all kinds of inadvertent problems came up precisely because of the incompetence of the companies. Diebold got into terrible trouble in California because their machines didn't work, because they lied to state election officials. All of this has been well documented in public hearings and public statements. And as I see Diebold as a company now, the overall company, not just the election part of it, I think their involvement in the election business has been a complete disaster for them. Their share prices have tanked. Their reputation has taken a dive. Their CEO, the one who wrote the fundraising letter, Wally O'Dell, was forced to resign a month ago. I wouldn't be at all surprised if they get out of the election business altogether. And if you look at the history of the election business, this has always been the way. Companies have come in. They thought they could make money. They discovered that suddenly they're involved with people who are indicted for embezzlement, fraud, all kinds of things. They find their reputation takes a dive, and they get back out again. And it's a really nasty, cutthroat business. And I think the solution there is not to point fingers and accuse companies of participating in political conspiracies. I think the answer is to have a structure of public accountability so that these companies, if they want to get involved in the business, they have to be open about what they do. They can't keep their software private and secret and proprietary, which is the case now. They have to not only have good products, but they have to demonstrate in a public and accountable way that that's what they've got. That's the answer. And that's something that Republicans and Democrats can get on board with. And the reason why I tend to be reluctant to jump on the Republicans too much is precisely because I think this has been turned into a partisan issue, and the only way to solve it is to unravel it and make it a voting rights issue again. And again, I don't think one should hold back at all on the outrage or the specific accusations against one party or the other in certain circumstances, and I would agree the Republicans have behaved outrageously in the last couple of election cycles, but I don't think we should stop there. We should look at the systemic problems and how they ebb and flow with the fortunes of the parties and attack the problem where it really begins, which is with the whole political structure in this country.
And just to pick up on the caller's comment about the punch cards, the problems with the punch cards led more and more people to say, okay, this technology doesn't work, let's have something else, and that's gets us to computerized systems. His point seemed to be that he thought there was nothing wrong with the punch cards. If you look at all of the ways that you could do it, what do you think about that, and is there, and I expect probably the answer is no, is there any technology that cannot, where the result cannot be manipulated?
Well, the quick answer to your last point is no.
That's kind of what I thought.
If you have elections, you're going to have bad elections. There's no two ways about that. But there are things that are better than other things. The punch cards were not a good technology for a number of reasons. Partly because they were badly maintained, but a lot of the reason why the Chad didn't detach or detached him properly was because the paper was not well manufactured, so that the knives that were used to make the scores that then became the Chads that were detached, they blunted over time. The managers in the different counties didn't replace certain key parts, so that the puncher didn't punch through the paper cleanly. But there are other reasons to think of the punch cards as being horribly outdated, prone to failure as well. That the average discard rate for punch card machines in Florida in 2000 was, I think, 3%. In certain counties, it was as high as 12%. So, you know, let's not kid ourselves. This is not a great technology. There are also problems with the computer tabulation, as I mentioned earlier, and there have been studies done. A man called Michael Shamos in Pennsylvania wrote a devastating critique of punch card machines as early as 1980, which was roundly ignored everywhere except for Pennsylvania, where he was in charge of purchasing voting systems. In terms of what the best system is now, I mean, most countries and most studies show that the most efficient system in the ideal sense is to have hand-counted paper ballots, because the great thing about paper is it can be recounted, it's there, it's concrete, it doesn't disappear into some kind of cyber ether. In the American context, I'm not convinced that is a workable system, because you have so many multi-race elections in this country. In Los Angeles, where I live, you've also got, you know, incredible logistical problems of different languages, different cities within the county, different unincorporated areas within the county, different school districts, you know, judges' races, the whole thing. If you had to do it all with hand-counted paper ballots, it would be a nightmare of logistics. And to be totally honest, the public sector in this country is so badly funded, including the management of elections, I don't think you could get the manpower to organize that properly. So you do need some kind of a machine. The machine that everybody seems to agree works the best is the MarkSense machine, which is where you have paper ballots where you fill in the little bubbles with a pencil according to which candidates or which initiatives you want to vote in favor of. Those are then scanned electronically. And the advantage of that system is, number one, it's pretty cheap. Number two, it's relatively easy to maintain. Number three, if there's any question about the result, you have paper you can go back to double check. I would say that this system is not used as well as it could be in a lot of parts of the country, because there isn't a proper random automatic manual recount after the fact. What you should do, and if you ask election officials from around the world, they'll all agree on this, is you should decide after the election which were the precincts where the vote was closest. Let's pick 1 or ideally 3% of the overall precincts and count those by hand to make sure the tabulation machines work properly. That happens in some parts of this country. It doesn't happen in others. It needs to happen everywhere, because as soon as you have computers and tabulation, it can be prone to error, it can be prone to manipulation, and that needs to be checked to the statistical satisfaction of the election managers. I think that would be the best way to go. The inherent philosophical problem with the touchscreen machines, over and above the fact that they've been demonstrated to be very badly programmed and riddled with errors, is that ultimately, because you don't have paper, and it's hard to produce paper, you can have an independent paper trail, but there's no guarantee that the voters will look at it as they're casting their votes. When you don't have paper, you don't have that fallback, and you can't do the check to make sure that the machine is working the way it's supposed to. The other problem with the touchscreen machines is they're massively expensive, and you've got these incredibly intricate computer systems that will go out of date quickly, that will be prone to various, you know, unimaginable at this point, viruses, other problems, security problems that might arise. And, you know, you have these incredibly complicated computer systems, and you're only using them once, twice, maximum 3 or 4 times a year. It's really not a very efficient use of machinery. They need to be stored. They need to be maintained. All of that. All of that's very expensive. So I think to have a relatively low-tech, easy-to-maintain system that has paper at its core, so you can go back and check and make sure the election is being conducted transparently. That's the way to go.
We have about 15 minutes left, maybe a little bit less. We have some callers we'll get right to. I just also, for anybody who has just recently tuned in, want to reintroduce our guest, Andrew Gumbel. He is a reporter, a U.S. correspondent for The Independent. It's a British newspaper. He is based in Los Angeles. He has also worked for The Guardian, another British paper, and also for Reuters. And he is the author of the book, Steal This Vote, that looks at the history of voting in America, going way back to the beginnings of the country. The subtitle is Dirty Elections and the Rotten History of Democracy in America. It's published by Nation Books. It's out now in paperback if you'd like to read it. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We have a caller in Indiana, in Lafayette, next, line number three. Hello.
Hello. You've discussed Florida in 2000. Can you address Illinois in 1960? Specifically, the best explanation I've heard for Nixon's odd refusal to demand a recount in a very close state, Illinois, isn't, because it's not conspiratorial, but it sounds pretty cynical, that Nixon knew or suspected that Republicans downstate had probably stolen as many votes there as Mayor Daley and the Democrats had stolen in Chicago. Does that make any sense to you?
Yes, I write about this in the book, and that is certainly a factor. One thing that occurred in elections in that period, I don't think it really happens anymore, is that you would have a kind of game of chicken between the two parties, that each would hold back returns in the parts of the state where they were strongest to wait and see what the other party did first. It was basically, you know, you have two thieves trying to carve up the booty after a robbery, and neither trust the other as far as they can spit. I think that that was a big part of Nixon's calculations. And there were other things, too. I think there was a sense as well that in this culture, if you complain about an election and you're not 100% sure you're going to come out prevailing as a result of your complaint, you get tagged with the sore loser epithet, and it can engage the wrath not only of the opponents who you are accusing of cheating, but also of your own party. That there's been a kind of a thieves' bargain between the Republicans and the Democrats for a very long time not to talk about any of this stuff. That's changing now in the wake of the 2000 election, which I think is a very good thing, which is why we're here, why a lot of the conversations that have gone on have gone on, and I think that's excellent. Casting light on a dark place is always the best way to clean up anything. But one thing that, you know, Nixon was very clear on in 1960 was he had the choice. He could either pursue the contest of the election and risk never being able to run for president again, or he could keep his mouth shut and do nothing. There was a friend of his who was an investigative reporter called Earl Mather who started looking into irregularities not only in Illinois but also in Texas, which was another one of the contested states in 1960. Earl Mather's reporting never really rose above the anecdotal. He didn't demonstrate any systemic way in which Nixon was deprived of votes. We still don't have a full answer on how that happened in Chicago. But we can be pretty sure it did happen. And Nixon's response was to call up Earl Mather and say, Earl, there's a very interesting article you're writing, but nobody in the United States steals a presidential election. So there's a kind of conspiracy of silence, if you like, not to talk about this stuff, that in the end, personal ambition rises above the desire to have a transparent system. And Nixon, as we know, went on in 1968 to run again and to win. And if he'd contested the election in 1960 in Illinois, he probably wouldn't have won, and his career would have probably been over. So that's, I think, the other factor that was involved.
All right, thank you. Perhaps if you have time, you could tell us if you see any virtue in abandoning the Electoral College. Thank you, sir.
All right. Well, you want to talk about that quickly? As I know that there, you do raise some concerns about the Electoral College in the book as well.
Right. Well, I think there's no good argument for keeping the Electoral College, other than the fact that logistically it's almost impossible to get rid of it because of what it takes to have constitutional changes in this country. I think Article 2 of the Constitution, which is just the one that governs elections, probably needs to be overhauled in general. It probably takes a foreigner to say this, but if you read that section of the Constitution, it is the most unbelievable dog's breakfast of an arrangement of how to run a country and run elections. And that's partly because of the compromises that were necessary to come up with a solution at the Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia in 1787. And it's partly because of the inability to change the system fundamentally since then. There are basically two arguments in favor of the Electoral College, and both of them are lousy as far as I'm concerned. One is this idea that, it's been with us for 200 years and it's served us very well. It has not served us very well. There have been a number of elections over the years, most of them in the 19th century, but the 2000 election is another very good recent example where the Electoral College caused something close to a constitutional crisis and a meltdown in the system. The other argument is this idea that somehow the Electoral College protects the interests of smaller states. Again, I think this is a bogus argument. If we see how the recent campaigns have gone, they focused on the battleground. Some of them have indeed been small states, some of them have been large states, but it hasn't been about campaigning across the country or making sure that the voices of voters in rural Wyoming are heard. That's not really the issue at all. Wyoming is a solid Republican state, so they didn't hear anything from Bush or Kerry or Bush or Gore in the last two elections. The other thing that I think makes the Electoral College anti-democratic is in non-competitive, non-battleground states, the motivation to go and vote is very, very small. So you have all kinds of constituencies around the country that don't really get heard at presidential election time. One very obvious group which has big historical resonances are black voters in the South. Most of those states that used to belong to the Confederacy at the time of the Civil War are solid Republican states. Black voters in those states tend to vote Democrat, and those states never go Democrat, so their voices are basically removed from contention. The same is true, if you look at a state like California or some other solid Democratic states, that the variety of Republican voices in those states is not heard. And I think if you had a direct proportional system for electing the president, you would see a lot more variation in the debates. You'd have a lot more variation in the campaigns. And it wouldn't be possible to pander to very narrow interests in order to get the vote out in very specific parts of the country. You'd have to appeal to a much broader range of the public, and I think you would have much more moderate candidates and much more moderate campaigns. So, for all these reasons, I think the Electoral College is an anachronism. It's frustrating that it can't be got rid of. I don't think anybody who's interested in democracy with a small c would argue in favor of it, but we're stuck with it.
Let's talk again with the Southern Illinois caller here, line number 4. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yeah, hi, thanks for your show. And Andrew, thanks for your book that delves into this. But I'd like to say, in reference to a previous caller, as far as soft-pedaling, I still think you're soft-pedaling because you said Gore should have won the election. Excuse me for correcting you, but he did win the election. Everyone in the world knows that, whatever legal mumbo-jumbo they went through. And the whole point of the Republicans stealing the election now, it's far worse than anything we've seen in history, because the election is core to our American way of life. They're corrupting our entire Constitution, our entire American way of life, our ideals. They're trying to legalize torture, yada, yada, yada. Everyone knows what they're doing. Most Americans are against it. So this only keeps happening because of all the soft peddling, all the spin, all the whitewash. And how the heck did Diebold just get a contract in Illinois? And you're right about the data secrecy. There should be no question. There should be no data secrecy, at least for investigators to figure out if the elections were corrupt. And I don't believe for a second that there were any bag programs. This is purposeful stuff being done, just like Katrina was on purpose that aid didn't get there. And the people know it. The people of the world know it. So let's stop the spinning. Let's stop the whitewash. Let's just end it, please. And you're a good one, so please help us end it. Thank you very much.
All right. Well, Mr. Gummel, you can comment on that however you like.
Well, I would shocking as what happened in 2000 was, and I do believe it was very shocking. I was here, I lived through the whole thing, and if you read the book, I haven't been able to go into the kind of detail I'd like to on the air because we don't have time. But you'll see, I'm extremely critical of what happened in the 2000 election in particular. I have some criticisms for the Gore campaign too, which I think is a reflection of the anti-democratic culture that exists in both parties. But without any doubt, it's the Republicans who denied Gore his, what I believe to be, you know, his rightful election as president of the United States. I would take issue that that is worse than anything that's happened in the past. Just to give you a couple of examples, the 1876 presidential election, when clearly the Democratic candidate, Samuel Tilden, had won, and in fact most newspapers the day after the election reported it as such, there was just an absolutely shameless campaign mounted by the dying Republican administrations in three southern states to deny the realities of the results that had come in, and to simply say that the Republican candidate, Rutherford B. Hayes, had won, and it created a crisis that went on for months, and in the end, Hayes became president, even though Tilden had almost certainly won. You know, as brazen a theft as that, you can't find. To take another quick example, the manner in which Lyndon Johnson won the Senate race in Texas in 1948, we now have incontrovertible evidence that that election was pulled off through the most colossal fraud, and it's an extraordinary story, not only how the fraud was perpetrated, but also how Johnson got away with it afterwards. Robert Carrad's book, Means of Ascent, describes it all in fantastic detail. You know, these are major outrages against the very idea of a democratic system, and they've gone on and off in this country for a very long time. The disenfranchisement of not only black voters in the South, but also most of the industrial working class in both the South and the North at the end of the 19th century. Again, a colossal betrayal of democratic interests. And, you know, one of the shocking things I discovered by delving into the history of this country is that there's obviously always been tremendous lip service to the idea of government of the people, by the people, for the people. But in practice, it hasn't worked out that way, and I think it needs to be unmasked, it needs to be understood, and, you know, that informs what's going on now. Mm. In terms of the current Republican Party, I do think there are a couple of things about it that make it particularly alarming, and historically particularly alarming. One is the influence of religious fundamentalism, which is not, I don't think, at the core of the party leadership, but it is very much part of the grassroots. And there's something about religious fundamentalism that is essentially, you know, inimical to the idea of representative democracy, because it suggests that God is the ultimate authority, not the voters. The other thing is I do think that there is a certain kind of way of fighting that the modern Republican Party has, which is particularly brazen and particularly shameless. But if you look at what's going on politically now, I'm not sure that if they keep going in that same direction, whether it's flouting what most people regard as the protections of the Constitution of civil liberties, whether it's the issue of torture, all those other things you raised, I'm not convinced that they're going to be able to push this much further without creating a rather large backlash.
And I must jump in there. My apologies, Mr. Gumbel, but we've got to stop because we're here at the end of the time.
Yeah.
I want to say thanks very much for talking with us. We certainly do appreciate it.
You're very welcome.
Our guest, Andrew Gumbel, is U.S. correspondent for the British newspaper The Independent. His book is Steal This Vote. It's published by Nation Books.